Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook paper and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. I finished the last show discussing a proposal for international currency yardstick that is not a currency. It brings us to the question of how best to stabilize national currencies. The simplest and most comprehensive measure for calibrating an international currency yardstick seems to be the Consumer Price Index proposed by Mann, modified to reflect the real daily expenditures of consumers. To show how such a system might work, I gave a hypothetical example. Assume that one international currency unit, an ICU, equals the Consumer Price Index, or some modified version of it, multiplied by some agreed-upon fraction. So, on January 1st of our hypothetical year, a computer sampling of all national markets indicates that the value of one ICU in the United States is $1. The same goods that $1 would purchase in the United States can be purchased in Mexico for 10 Mexican pesos and in England for half a British pound. These are the actual prices of the selected goods in each country's currency within its own borders, as determined by supply and demand. When you cross the Mexican border, you can trade a dollar bill for 10 pesos or a British pound for 20 pesos. On either side of the border, one ICU worth of goods can be bought with those sums of money in their respective denominations. Carlos, who has a business in Mexico, buys 10,000 ICUs worth of goods from Sam, who has a business in the United States. Carlos pays for the goods with 100,000 Mexican pesos. Sam takes the pesos to his local branch of the now federalized Federal Reserve and exchanges them at the prevailing exchange rate for 10,000 U.S. dollars. The Fed sells the pesos at the prevailing rate to other people interested in conducting trade with Mexico. When the Fed accumulates excess pesos, or a positive trade balance, they are sold to the Mexican government for U.S. dollars at the prevailing exchange rate. If the Mexican government runs out of U.S. dollars, the U.S. government can either keep the excess pesos in reserve, or it can buy anything it wants that Mexico has for sale, including but not limited to gold and other commodities. The following year, Mexico has an election and a change of governments. The new government decides to fund many new social programs with newly printed currency, expanding the supply of Mexican pesos by 10%. Under the classical quantity theory of money, this increase in demand, money that is, will inflate prices, pushing the prices of one ICU in Mexico to around 11 Mexican pesos. That is the conventional theory, but Keynes maintained that if the new pesos were used to produce new goods and services, supply would increase along with demand, leaving prices unaffected. Whichever theory proves to be correct, the point here is that the value of the peso would be determined by the actual price on the Mexican market of the goods in the modified consumer price index, not by the quantity of Mexican currency traded on international currency markets by speculators. Currencies would no longer be traded as commodities, fetching what the market would bear, and they would no longer be vulnerable to speculative attack. They would just be coupons for units of value recognized globally, units stable enough that commercial traders could bank on them. If labor and materials were cheaper in one country than another, it would be because they were more plentiful or accessible there, not because the country's currency had been devalued by speculators. The national currency would become what it should be all along, a contract or promise to return value in goods or services of a certain worth as measured against a universally recognized yardstick for determining value. And this leads us to getting over the rainbow. Government without taxes or debt, just like in The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy said, "Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. We must be over the rainbow." Going over the rainbow suggests a radical visionary shift, a breakthrough into a new way of seeing the world. We've come to the end of the yellow brick road, and only a radical shift in our concepts of money and banking will save us from the cement wall looming ahead. We, the people, got lost in a labyrinth of debt when we allowed paper money to represent an illusory sum of gold held by private bankers, who multiplied it many times over in the guise of fractional reserve lending. The result was a Ponzi scheme that has pumped the global money supply into a gigantic credit bubble. As bond investor Bill Gross said in a February 2004 newsletter, "We have been skipping down this yellow brick road of capitalism, paved not with gold, but with thick coats of debt leverage that requires constant maintenance." The levies that have kept a flood of debt leverage from collapsing the economy showed signs of cracking on February 27, 2007, when the Dow Jones Industrial Average suddenly dropped by more than 500 points. The drop was triggered by a series of events like those initiating the Great Crash of 1929. And I'll return to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So as I was saying, the levies that have kept a flood of debt leverage from collapsing the economy showed signs of cracking on February 27, 2007, when the Dow Jones Industrial Average suddenly dropped by more than 500 points. The drop was triggered by a series of events like those initiating the Great Crash of 1929. A nearly 9% decline in China's stock market set off a wave of selling in U.S. markets to satisfy margin calls, requiring investors using credit to add cash to their accounts to bring them to a certain minimum balance. The Chinese drop, in turn, was triggered by an intentional credit squeeze by Chinese officials who were concerned that Chinese homeowners were mortgaging their homes and businessmen were pledging their businesses as collateral to play the over-leveraged Chinese stock market. Commentators suggested that the Dow fell by only 500 points because of the behind-the-scenes maneuvering of the plunge protection team, the Counterparty Risk Management Policy Group, and the Federal Reserve. But it was all just window dressing, a dog and pony show to keep investors lulled into complacency, inducing them to keep betting on a stock market nag on its last legs. A bigger crisis next time might not be so easy to conceal behind a facade of prosperity. Like at the end of the Roaring Twenties, we are again looking down the trough of the business cycle, mortgaged up to the gills and at risk of losing it all. We own nothing that can't be taken away. The housing market could go into a tailspin, and so could the stock market. The dollar could collapse, and so could our savings. Even Social Security and pensions could soon be things of the past. Before the economy collapses and our savings and security go with it, we need to reverse the sleight of hand that created the banker's Ponzi scheme. The constitutional provision that Congress shall have the power to coin money needs to be updated so that it covers the national currency in all its forms, including the 97% now created with accounting entries by private commercial banks. That modest change could transform the dollar from a vice for wringing the lifeblood out of a nation of sharecroppers into a bell for ringing in the millennial abundance envisioned by our forefathers. The government could actually eliminate taxes and the federal debt while expanding the services it provides. The pieces to the monetary puzzle have been concealed by layers of deception built up over 400 years, and it has taken some time to unravel them. But the picture has now come clear, and we are ready to recap what we have found. The global debt web has been spun from a string of frauds, deceits, and sleights of hand, including 1. Fractional reserve banking. Fractional reserve banking was formalized in 1694 with the Charter for the Bank of England. The modern banking system involves credit issued by private bankers that is ostensibly backed by reserves. At one time, these reserves consisted of gold, but today they are merely government securities, which are promises to pay. The banking system lends these securities many times over, essentially counterfeiting them. That's problem number one, and it is big. Fractional reserve banking. Number two, the gold standard. In the 19th century, the government was admonished not to issue paper fiat money on the ground that it would produce dangerous inflation. The bankers insisted that paper money had to be backed by gold. What they failed to disclose was that there was not nearly enough gold in their own vaults to back the privately issued paper notes laying claim to it. The bankers themselves were dangerously inflating the money supply based on a fictitious gold standard that allowed them to issue loans many times over on the same gold reserves, collecting interest each time. The third part of the puzzle was, and is, the Federal Reserve. Established in 1913 to create a national money supply, the Federal Reserve is not federal, and today it keeps nothing in reserve except government bonds or IOUs. It is a private banking corporation authorized to issue its own Federal Reserve notes and sell them to other financial institutions, which then lend them to the government, individuals, and businesses. Except for coins, which make up only about 1/10,000th of the money supply, The entire U.S. money supply is now created by the private Federal Reserve and private banks by extending loans to the government and to individuals and businesses. The fourth piece was the federal debt and the money supply. The United States went off the gold standard in the 1930s, but the fractional reserve system continued, backed by reserves of government bonds. The federal debt these securities represent is never paid off, but is continually rolled over, forming the basis of the national money supply. As a result of this highly inflationary scheme, by the fall of 2008, the federal debt passed $10 trillion and was approaching the point at which the interest alone would be more than the public could afford to pay. In fact, by the year 2012, the federal debt is beyond $15.5 trillion, and the government is totally incapable through the tax system and other public sources to pay the interest alone on this debt. The fifth point is the federal income tax. Considered unconstitutional for over a century, the federal income tax was ostensibly legalized in 1913 by the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. It was instituted primarily to secure a reliable source of money to pay the interest due to the banks on the government's securities, and that continues to be its principal use today. The sixth point is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the International Monetary Fund. A principal function of the Federal Reserve was to bail out banks that got overextended in the fractional reserve shell game using money created in open market operations by the Fed. When the Federal Reserve failed in that backup function, the FDIC and then the IMF were instituted, ensuring that mega banks considered too big to fail would get bailed out no matter what unwarranted risks they took. The seventh point is the free market. The theory that businesses in America prosper or fail due to free market forces is a total myth. While smaller corporations and individuals who miscalculate their risks may be left to their fate in the market, mega banks and corporations considered too big to fail are protected by a form of federal welfare available only to the rich and powerful. Other distortions in free market forces result from the covert manipulations of a variety of powerful entities. Virtually every market is now manipulated, whether by federal mandate or by institutional speculators, hedge funds, and large multinational banks colluding on trades. And I'll get to point eight in a moment. For those of you just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, continuing our analysis of the global debt web, which frankly has been spun from a string of frauds, deceits, and sleights of hand, we're on number eight, the Plunge Protection Team and the Counterparty Risk Management Policy Group, sometimes called the CRMPG. Federal manipulation is done by the Working Group on Financial Markets, also known as the Plunge Protection Team, the PPT. The PPT is authorized to use U.S. Treasury funds to rig markets in order to maintain investor confidence, keeping up the appearance that all is well. Manipulation is also effected by a private fraternity of big New York banks and investment houses known as the CRMPG, which was set up to bail its members out of financial difficulty by colluding to influence markets, again with the blessing of the government, and to the detriment of the small investors on the other side of these orchestrated trades. Point number nine is the floating exchange rate. Manipulation and collusion also occur in international currency markets. Rampant currency speculation was unleashed in 1971 when the United States defaulted on its promise to redeem its dollars in gold internationally. National currencies were left to float against each other, trading as if they were commodities rather than receipts for fixed units of value. The result was to remove the yardstick for measuring value, leaving currencies vulnerable to attack by international speculators prowling in these dangerous commercial waters. Point number 10 is the infamous short sale. To bring down competitor currencies, speculators use a device called the short sale, the sale of currency the speculator does not own but has theoretically borrowed just for purposes of sale. Like fractional reserve lending, the short sale is actually a form of counterfeiting. When speculators sell a currency short in massive quantities, its value is artificially forcing down the value of goods traded in it. The 11th point is globalization and free trade. Before a currency can be brought down by speculative assault, the country must be induced to open its economy to free trade and to make its currency freely convertible into other currencies. The currency can then be attacked and devalued, allowing national assets to be picked up at fire sale prices and forcing the country into bankruptcy. The bankrupt country must then borrow from international banks and the IMF, which impose as a condition of debt relief that the national government may not issue the money it needs, but must borrow it from international lenders. If the government tries to protect its resources or its banks by nationalizing them for the benefit of its own citizens, it is branded communist, socialist, or terrorist, and is replaced by one that is friendlier to free enterprise. Locals who fight back are termed terrorists or insurgents. Point 12, inflation myths. The runaway inflation suffered by third world countries has been blamed on irresponsible governments running the money printing presses, when in fact these disasters have usually been caused by speculative attacks on the national currency. Devaluing the currency forces prices to shoot up overnight. Creeping inflation, like that seen in the United States today, is also blamed on governments irresponsibly printing money when it is actually caused by private banks inflating the money supply with debt. Banks advance new money as loans that must be repaid with interest, but the banks don't create the interest necessary to service the loans. New loans must continually be taken out to obtain the money to pay the interest, forcing prices up in an attempt to cover this new cost, spiraling the economy into perpetual price inflation. Point 13 is the business cycle. As long as banks keep making low interest loans, the money supply expands and business booms. But when the credit bubble gets too large, the central bank goes into action to deflate it. Interest rates are raised, loans are called, and the money supply shrinks, forcing debtors into foreclosure, delivering their homes and farms to the banks. This is called the business cycle, as if it were a natural condition like the weather. In fact, it is a natural characteristic only of a monetary scheme in which money comes into existence as a debt to private banks for reserves of something lent many times over. Point 14 is the home mortgage boondoggle. A major portion of the money created by banks today originates with the monetization of home mortgages. The borrower thinks he is borrowing pre-existing funds when the bank is just turning his promise to repay into an asset secured by real property. By the time the mortgage is paid off, the borrower has usually paid the bank more in interest than was owed on the original loan, and if he defaults, the bank winds up with the house, although the money advanced to purchase it was created with accounting entries. That leads to point number 15, the housing bubble. until 2007, the dollar and the economy were being supported by a housing boom that was initiated when the Fed pushed interest rates to very low levels after the stock market collapsed in 2000, significantly shrinking the money supply. Easy credit pumped the money supply back up and saved the market investments of the Fed's member banks, but it also led to a housing bubble that would inevitably collapse as well, sending the economy to the trough of the business cycle once again. Part of this was point 16, the adjustable rate mortgage, or ARM. After interest rates were dropped to very low levels, the housing bubble was fanned into a blaze through a series of high-risk changes in mortgage instruments, including variable rate loans, that allowed nearly anyone to qualify to buy a home who would take the bait. By 2005, about half of all U.S. mortgages were at adjustable interest rates. Purchasers were lulled by teaser rates into believing they could afford mortgages that were liable to propel them into inextricable debt, if not into bankruptcy. Payments could increase by 50% after 6 years just by their terms, and could increase by 100% if interest rates went up by a mere 2% in 6 years. Point 17 is that there is a secret bankruptcy of the banks. The banks themselves were taking enormous risks with these housing loans, as well as with very risky investments known as derivatives, which are basically side bets that some asset will go up or down. Banks were led into these dangerous waters because traditional commercial banking had proven to be an unprofitable venture. While banks have the power to create money as loans, they also have the obligation to balance their books, and when borrowers default, the losses must be made up from the bank's profits. Faced with a wave of bad debts and lost business, banks have kept afloat by branching out into the economically destructive derivatives business and by colluding with each other and the government to arrange periodic stealth bailouts when banks considered too big to fail become insolvent. Point number 18 is vulture capitalism and the derivatives cancer. At one time, banks served the community by providing loans to developing businesses. But today, this essential credit function is being replaced by a form of vulture capitalism in which banks' investment departments and affiliated hedge funds are buying out shareholders and bleeding businesses of their profits using loans of phantom money created on a computer screen. Banks are also funding speculative derivative bets in which money that should be going into economic productivity is merely gambled on money making money in the casino of the markets. Outstanding derivatives are now counted in the hundreds of trillions of dollars, many times the money supply of the world. And the final point, number 19, is moral hazard. The derivatives bubble is showing clear signs of imploding, and when it does, those banks considered too big to fail will expect to be bailed out from the consequences of their risky loans, just as they have been in the past. So it is at this point in our story, if it is to have a happy ending, that we, the people, must snap ourselves awake, stand up, and say enough. The banker's extremity is our opportunity. We can be kept indebted and enslaved only if we continue to underwrite bank profligacy. As Mike Whitney wrote in March 2007, the Federal Reserve will keep greasing the printing presses and diddling the interest rates until someone takes away the punch bowl and the party comes to an end. It is up to us, an awakened and informed populace, to take away the punch bowl. Private commercial banking, as we know it, is obsolete, and we'll continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.